Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's April 3rd, 2024. My name's Eric Osterman, and I'll be your host. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for funded startups and enterprises that helps teams who are overwhelmed with AWS. We do this by using our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So no matter where you find yourself on this journey, we're here to help your startup launch better products faster so you can free up your bandwidth for innovation and nail your value delivery every time. So if you or your team has been banging your head against the wall with underperforming infrastructure, just head to cloudposse.com/quiz, answer a few quick questions, and we'll chart a roadmap for success. Again, that's cloudposse.com/quiz. So how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format is informal. Engage as much as you'd like. Ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. And for those on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. Join us by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. And you'll get an invite right to your email inbox. So I do have one ask. If you find any portion of our session today valuable, please share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse, or maybe share a short testimonial about the value you're getting. So let's get into some announcements. Well, the news is probably not news anymore because, I don't know, my LinkedIn and my news feeds and Twitter have been just inundated with posts about the very scary XZ backdoor that was planted. And for those who haven't been following the story, XZ is a compression library. It's used in a lot of Linux utilities. It's used as part of SSH, OpenSSH. When certain flags are enabled. And this backdoor was discovered just by total happenstance. Some curious developer doing some profiling over at Microsoft discovered an anomaly that his logins were always taking 500 milliseconds too long to execute. Most people wouldn't think more about it, but he was running Valgrind and some other utilities and came up with some crashes and decided to dig in further. And then he discovered a recent backdoor that had been implanted into the XZ library. Now, this is a really interesting study. And if you look at this post that we'll share after the meeting, it's a timeline of how long this attack took to orchestrate and how lucky we were that it was discovered at least in the time that we did, because it could have been a real catastrophe if it had gotten out into more Linux distributions and so forth. So it starts with a smaller library, this XZ library that is widely used in lots of projects, but has a single maintainer. You've seen the meme of the open source ecosystem where all of this infrastructure sits and depends on this one dependency, which is maintained by a single developer. And that single developer, unfortunately, had his 15 minutes of fame this week, Lasse Kallen. And this developer had built up a trust with Jia Tan, which is presumably a pseudonym. We don't know who this person is, but they had created a GitHub account in 2021, had no history, basically just started opening up a few benign pull requests, updating documentation or adding like an editor's config, I think was one of the things, and eventually built up some trust with the maintainer, ultimately getting contributor or maintainer access to that repository, and slowly began introducing things that would enable this backdoor to be created. It's interesting also because, Cloud Posse is an open source company and we rely on contributors out there, and software is only as strong as its weakest link, and often the weakest link is humans. What's interesting about this attack is this Jia Tan was, you know, using some, you know, basically negging against the maintainer not doing a good enough job, that that the project should open up to more maintainers and so forth, and ultimately was able to become a maintainer as part of that project. I see this in our projects as well. You know, people reaching out, wanting to become maintainers. But it's also, you know, the first thing you do is you do look at the history of the person. You meet with those people live, and you know, you suss them out. But that's, you know, that's not a guarantee that you know who you're working with. Anyways, I'm curious, you know, anyone else who's been following this story closer or has any other insights as to what happened with this XZ vulnerability. Oh, and about that backdoor, it enabled full root login via SSH without any you know, prompts or anything getting in the way. Just clear, dropped you right into shell as root. I've also seen some example repos showing you how you can test it and reproduce it locally, if you're curious. All right, next announcement. Ah, it's doing this thing again. That's so annoying. Let me stop sharing here again. Huh, it's still sharing. I thought I stopped sharing. But anyways, now you see my screen again. All right. So Local Stack has really turned a corner in the past couple months. It's been around for a very long time. It's not an overnight success. But apparently with Local Stack V3, I didn't mean to send that thumbs down. That was Zoom doing something there. Apparently with V3 of OpenStack, it's reached a new milestone of stability and feature parity with at least AWS. So lots of great news coming out around it. One of the interesting things we've heard from one of our members of our community is they were able to get almost the entire Cloud Posse reference architecture running inside of LocalStack. So that was pretty awesome. Now, this is something different. This is an interesting extension to LocalStack, which will let you replicate an environment existing within AWS and bring that up underneath LocalStack. You know, your mileage may vary, but it sounded really interesting as a way for testing things out locally with minimal effort. Curious, anybody using LocalStack successfully today?
I was actually pretty extensively using it at my last place.
Oh, you were?
For testing basically the equivalent of an Atmos component. So we weren't using Atmos, but like actually deploying a full networking stack with VPCs and all of that. Yeah, sometimes you get into very niche roadblocks. Like we're using the paying feature because the basic one doesn't have all the services that it has a lot of services, like the free one, but there are services that are not emulated in the open source one. And you need the paying one. But even with that, there's some very, very niche edge cases that can happen. So yeah, it did end up opening some issues and they got back to it after a few weeks. But yeah, it was very good. But you did hit some. It's not real AWS. It's very, yeah, very close. But
well, you're testing. Yeah, you're not. It's not for scale. It's for testing, integration testing, basically.
Yeah.
In other news, Cloudflare has introduced support for Python workers. Previously, it only supported Node.js. I don't know the details of it, but it's worth checking out if you are a Python shop, I suppose. There's been a lot of news about the Redis relicensing that happened, fresh on the heels of HashiCorp relicensing many of their open source products under BSL. This is a similar move. They've chosen a different license. As expected, a fork emerged pretty quickly. What is interesting, though, is just who's backing the fork. Every major cloud provider. Redis has become part of the fabric of how services run today. Every major cloud offers it. The wire protocol of Redis is pretty simple, and the backend is obviously more complicated. Other forks had already existed of Redis for various reasons. This is based on Valkey, and I don't believe Valkey was a new fork, but they are the one that won out here. Anybody more familiar with the history of Valkey? All right.
I'm not familiar with it, but you know what I like about this fork? If you visit the GitHub page for it.
Was it here or was it?
You'll see that it doesn't have a logo or icon. And I remember a LinkedIn post when the drama started happening, and the author was like, "Everybody, let's just take a weekend to figure out what the logo and the icon should be and the name, so we don't have this same debacle that we had in the beginning of OpenTofu when that drama happened." So, I mean, I guess this predates it. It's been for 5 years, but it's just kind of funny. You know, it doesn't, it has no logo whatsoever. And if you, even if you click the website, it just takes you like the, it's not a landing page. It just goes back to this GitHub repo.
Oh, it's just
So no logo whatsoever.
I'm sure that's all going to change pretty soon. But I am, like if this is a fork, you can't really just look at the Git history because that'll have the original history of Redis as well. I'm curious when Valkey came into existence, but my quick scanning isn't seeing that. All right, next announcement. So the other side of the story, it's haters gonna hate. It's fun to bash. I admit that I'm not favorable of all these license changes happening in open source. I think all these changes to licensing happening in open source projects is chipping away at the trust that open source has managed to establish in the enterprise world among companies. And it's not going to take, well, I mean, it's going to erode some of that trust and make it harder for some players, for example, even Cloud Posse. If more of these companies are changing their licensing, there will be more distrust of other open source projects that they will not switch license, leaving customers or users on the line. So, I really don't understand this Redis move, changing the licensing when it was so absolutely inevitable overnight that a fork would emerge. And I don't see what defensibility it really gives them to own the brand name of Redis and how that's going to increase their sales. But then again, we're not a billion-dollar company. I don't know. So this post here is taking the other side of the coin, arguing why this was the right thing for Redis to do, and why AWS, Google, and everyone else is in the wrong, and how they are responsible for this happening and could have prevented it. I'm, obviously biased in this whole thing. We'll share a link to this. Anyone have other insights or thoughts on this? All right. And let's see. Chekhov just caught this on Reddit. It sounds like the IDE integration for Chekhov now does require a API key. And if you were using that, that might not be working anymore. I think like if you're still using Chekhov and GitHub Actions, that probably still works. So, you know, I'm pretty tired of announcing new Terraform registries and provider registries. This is not one of those. Not too many of these projects have come out, so I thought I'd announce this. I saw it via Awesome Terraform links. It's a self-managed backend service for Terraform, supporting locking, versioning, rollbacks, and all the like, written in Elixir. I'm not personally sure why I'd want to self-host the backend for Terraform, especially since you need infrastructure to host the infrastructure that you use for Terraform. I kind of like to think about my state backend as just existing and working as with as little infrastructure as possible. But I guess in an enterprise context, maybe it makes sense where you have a team whose responsibility is managing these other things for others. Has interesting things on the horizon, including plans for managing access controls better. I don't believe, I'm not sure to what extent, you know, it supports fine-grained permissions for team collaboration. And lastly, if you're an AWS customer, you might dig this. If you have a relation, you know, professional relationship with your account rep or sales reps, you can now communicate via Slack Connect. Previously, AWS, Amazon, the company, had blocked Slack Connect. You could not send a Connect invitation. Now you can. So you can have a direct line of communication with your sales rep or your account rep at AWS. This is also nice for partners like Cloud Posse. And we're not forced into using Chime. Chime has gotten better, but it's certainly no Slack equivalent. So I'm excited about this. And oh, Alex shared a link here relating to the Chekhov one. Oh, actually opened by Alex himself. So yeah, I'll upload that for you, Alex. And I'm not sure if this is say enterprise here only. Yeah, I don't think this is necessarily enterprise. Every customer of Amazon has an account rep. That account rep just might have, you know, anywhere from, well, if you're enterprise, they might have, you know, five accounts. And then if you're, you know, Greenfield or something, it might be 100 or something. All right. So let's get into the Q&A. Hey, Alex, you know, last week, I think we finally got to answer your question, but it did happen after you left. Were you able to listen to that recording, Alex?
No, I haven't had a chance yet.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
No worries.
But if you have any more questions after listening to that one, we went through all the different patterns for doing migrations. Whether it's a separate repository or part of the same deployment process. And
Nice. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
yeah, sure thing. Sorry it took so long. And let's see here. Rohan, do we have you on the line today? Boy, trying to find who's participating here. I don't see Rohan. It sounded like he wanted to join. I'll take a quick pass at answering the question. Obviously, it's always better to answer these if we have the original question posted. So let me first open it up here in Slack. Where was that? Oops, wrong window. Let me respond here. Has anybody else been getting the office hour, this the waiting page here for office hours? Just curious.
Yeah, I had it earlier, but that was apparently there was like a an older calendar invite. So there was like
Yeah,
two.
that might have been it. We used to allow join before host, but we just turned that off because there were a lot of people joining and just like picking their nose and stuff, and we'd accidentally publish that. So we added this, so it can't happen now. All right, so question from Rohan. All right, so they have a product that they're delivering as a Kubernetes service. They are using Helm to package and distribute it so a customer can run that on-prem. So, you know, the customer brings their own infrastructure and should just install the Helm chart. Now, you know, this seems pretty easy. This sounds like the perfect use case for Kubernetes and Helm. The reality is, of course, that Kubernetes is not the same depending on how it's been set up. I mean, even if you're on AWS, if you're not using EKS, well, then, you know, Lord have mercy. And if you are using EKS, well, you're probably a few versions behind, and there's constant requirements to maintain EKS and how you manage IAM roles and pod identities and so forth depends on the platform team running your Kubernetes cluster. And then repeat that whole process for Google Cloud and repeat that whole plot process for AKS and DigitalOcean or any other provider. So it is a difficult problem to solve. So without having Rohan on the line, it's hard to give a prescriptive solution for this. Instead, I would challenge to think about all, well, what are the assumptions here? If it's a single customer and you have this commitment to deliver your software to them, great. That you can make a lot of you, that simplifies a lot. But if you don't have that privilege, it gets complicated real fast. How do they get the Docker images? Are you know, are they in your ECR? Are you even using ECR? How are you know, are those images public? Are they private? And if they're private, how are you granting the IAM to the customer's accounts? Are they deploying it to multiple accounts? That gets complicated. In the cluster deploying your services, you also can't take anything for granted, like depending on how they do ingress. In this example, it says, you know, installing the ALB load balancer controller. I mean, if I was bringing my own cluster, I wouldn't want some Helm chart deploying the load balancer controller. I handle ingress the way I handle ingress, and we have a mature process for doing that. So I could understand for less mature companies operating Kubernetes, or if you're just grant or handed an empty Kubernetes cluster, there are different considerations. But also the other challenge is as soon as you start deploying a lot of these Helm charts for other services, things like the ALB controller, you have another problem. You need the IAM roles to be able to provision those resources. And an ALB controller actually is quite useless without a Route 53 DNS name, for example, pointed to your load balancer. If you want to have TLS, that's the only way you can really do it with the ALB controllers. You have to have a DNS name. And if you have to have a DNS name and you're deploying this in an enterprise context, can that consumer of your chart even get a DNS name for your service? We've had to deal with this in certain enterprise context, and it's surprising how many of our assumptions are thrown out the window working in these things because of enterprise controls, security teams, division of responsibilities, and so forth. So that's why I would, you know, suggest possibly looking into an alternative approach, which is replicated. Replicated is how Terraform Cloud or Terraform Enterprise is distributed. Lots of other enterprise software is distributed through replicated, and it's expensive, but it's, you know, it's a hard problem to solve, and that's what they've solved, and that's why you kind of pay for it. The times that we've tried to help customers do this has ultimately ended up with not using Kubernetes, like using fat VM images with everything on it and just distributed in AMI. But even then, it's complicated because you need to build that AMI in every region that the customer's operating in, and give them access. So, yeah, curious what other people have dealt with. Yonatan, I saw you talked about your experience previously working at Codefresh, having to distribute Codefresh enterprise runners and things like that. Anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I actually have a pretty clear response for him, for the individual who asked this question. I mean, I'm making a few assumptions, but basically I told him, if you click the link for that I posted there, the first link there, we had a similar problem when I was working at my last place, which was Codefresh, and this is our on-prem installation of the entire CI/CD platform, and you can connect it to your own runners. And this that you don't need to deploy their prerequisites for them, because the reality is you have different types of customers. The load balancer, the AWS load balancer controller, is a good example because we support both Nginx Ingress controller and AWS load balancer controller. Because we have customers using one and we have other customers using the other. So his question was, how do I automate everything end to end, including this Vault script to insert this secret into my cluster so that the service account can work? And so my answer is to basically do what we did here and to separate the equation. So you're packaging a, you're authoring a Helm chart. And you say, I need some prerequisites. You need to have an Ingress controller. You need these types of secrets for your service account. How you do that, it's up to you. And yeah, on one hand, you're giving up some automation, but how can you automate everything for every single type of customer? And we supported, it wasn't only different Ingress controllers that we supported. We supported customers on the GCP. We supported customers on Azure. We support customers that are actually using OpenShift. So you can't automate everything. But specifically, so that's kind of my non-answer for automating everything. But there is something in his, in Ron's question where he talks about the Vault script. So if you go back to Slack, and yeah, the reason why I basically showed the Artifact Cup is because it's like extensively documented. Like you just see like how many different options the customer could potentially choose, which the downside is that you need like support engineers to guide through big enterprise installations. But the flip, the good side of that is that you support many different types of customers. But the bit with the secret is I recommended he uses a Kubernetes operator for that. So external secrets operator has a Vault backend. So he can eliminate that script that to inject that secret into the cluster, and then instead ask customers, you could be using external secrets operator with AWS Secrets Manager as the backend, or we'll also support Vault. You can use that. Doesn't matter how you get that secret in. We're just templating the secret name for the service account, so that's like a value in our Helm chart. So you can just point it to whatever secret you populated. You need an Ingress controller. You can either use AWS Load Balancer controller or Nginx Ingress controller. Once those prerequisites are met, you pull up the chart and it comes up naturally. So I think the issue is with trying to automate everything and package the prerequisites, and that's basically my answer.
Yeah. I think those that's valid. And if there is an operator that solves some of your problems and doesn't require a lot of other like IAM roles and permissions, I think it's a no-brainer. External secrets operator with Vault would be an example like that because it doesn't need any cloud permissions other than the Vault token. And that would be, well, I guess when you install that operator, you still need to provide that token somehow, probably. So it's an off by one problem. I wonder how to solve. The only other thing I wanted to throw in there is a tool that has we've used over the years, and it's a Swiss Army knife. Look, it's not a, I don't want to say it's not an elegant solution because the elegant solutions these days is Argo CD, Flux, customize, things like that. But a Swiss Army knife of utility for deploying Helm charts where you have, other dependencies and you need hooks and you need to coordinate how it all comes together and have complex environments, perhaps. The answer for that has been Helm file. It's still a well-maintained project and in use by thousands of companies and worth checking out. Helm file is a way to define the configuration for all your charts and how they come together in a way you can automate in a consistent way that's documented, as opposed to using shell scripts and custom homemade methods of doing that. All right, so that was that question. I see a hand went up, Elvis.
Hey, Eric. Yeah, so I don't know if you guys use the AWS EKS Blueprints add-on, which actually has all the nice add-ons that
That's a good point.
we just implemented that, and it's pretty easy to deploy those
Yeah.
ESO external DNS and Circuit Manager, so it's kind of
Yeah. So, I
easy.
mean, this comes back down to what assumptions. I mean, if they're only supporting AWS customers with their Helm chart, then presumably only supporting EKS, requiring certain add-ons be installed with the cluster is another good solution. For partial solution for the problem. All right. Anybody have something else to add to this? All right. Then I thought I'd bring up something. It wasn't specifically asked for office hours, but I just thought it was an interesting conversation. It's come up a lot lately. It was something that we recently dealt with at Cloud Posse, so I thought I'd share the solution we arrived at. So let me introduce the problem or the question first, and it was around GitHub and how do you manage your repositories and the settings of your repositories. So, since a lot of us are Terraformers, the natural inclination is just to use Terraform to manage Git. I think it's a pretty elegant solution if you think about it, because, well, you're already managing all your other infrastructure. Why not manage GitHub the same way? If you already have GitOps and you're managing things through continuous delivery with Terraform, this is a really convenient way to open pull requests, to create repositories and manage settings and so forth. A few things I've seen a lot of companies try and solve this for a while. I know for a long time, or I know for a while, a company Mineros, makers of Terramate. I can never figure out how to spell their name, but Mineros had a basically turnkey solution for managing GitHub repositories. And in order to accomplish that, I know they had to fork the provider for GitHub. And I believe the provide, let's see here what they have here. Yeah, Terraform provider GitHub. But this looks like it was last updated 2 years ago. So it looks abandoned to me. And this one here was a fork of another attempt at fixing those problems, which was here, integrations. Okay, no, I guess this is the official one here. Well, maybe it's been fixed upstream. I don't know, but it's worth checking out what problems they had to mitigate if you're using it. But the first problem that everyone has when they start using the GitHub provider for Terraform are rate limits on Terraform, or rate limits on GitHub. So obviously you're going to be using a credential. It's going to be a pretty privileged credential to create the repositories. And I forget what the rate limits are, but there may be 4,000 or so, 5,000 API requests per hour. And when you are creating a factory inside of Terraform, where you have knowledge of every repository that you're managing, and the provider is going to have to call out to GitHub many times for every single repository, it doesn't take long before hitting those API limits. You know, if it's very if it's not a very active process where you're creating repos all the time, it'll be less of a problem. But then suddenly, for some reason, you create three repos in an hour and bam, you have a problem. You're not able to do anything. You're waiting for the rate limits to clear up. So the fix for that is to change the architecture for how you use Terraform to provision those repositories. And this is where we talk about with Atmos. This is the tool that we use at Cloud Posse for managing Terraform. And one of our best patterns that we talk about for components is to create your factories inside of Atmos itself. So in Atmos, you have a configuration. And that configuration, let's see here, if I think it's maybe under the stacks best practices here. I guess it was maybe components. There were just too many for me to see here. Factory. There we go. So what you want to do when terraforming your repositories is make sure that there's a one-to-one correlation between the state and the repository. So every repo has its own state. Then when you write your Terraform code and your configuration using Atmos, you can ensure that only the repos whose settings were modified are the ones that will be replanned and reapplied when there are changes. If you don't do it this way, for example, in native Terraform, if you have 100 repos in your configuration, every single time you run a Terraform plan, it's going to use up almost, several thousand of those API requests in one Terraform plan. And that's why it fails. So in Atmos, that configuration would be handled through stacks and stack configurations. We don't Terraform our stacks, our GitHub repository, so I don't have an example to show on that. So instead, I'm going to jump over to show how we solved it at Cloud Posse recently. And it comes with pros and cons. I'll get into that in a second here. Where repository settings. How does Yeah, there it is. So this is an app. It's been around for a long time. It's a ProBot app. You can use the hosted version or you can self-host it. I believe there's a Helm chart and a container for it as well. It supports pretty much the entire schema of a GitHub repository that you can configure. Why did that link not work? Configuration self, here we go. No. There we go. So what you do is simply add a file to your repository that describes all the settings of that repository. And if you look at the GraphQL response from GitHub for what a repository, you can see all the fields that you can configure basically through this configuration. It's also nice because it's written in ProBot, it supports this extends keyword. So I'm going to show you a real live example of what we're doing at Cloud Posse. And this is a good starting off point if you want to introduce something at your organization. So in your .github repo for your organization, you can create a file in the .github folder of the GitHub repository called settings. This is your base configuration. So here's the base configuration of every one of our repositories. This helps us ensure that we have the right teams added to every repo, and it ensures that we have a consistent labels and label colors and label descriptions for everything. You can even set up your environments and the protection rules for those environments in that configuration. Then when you go over to any one of your repos, for example, like our EKS cluster repo, if I go into the .github and look at the settings here, you'll see a keyword here of extends. And this is saying that it inherits the configuration from the organizational.github repository. It doesn't have to be the .github repo. That's the convention we chose. We're using the .github repo as the central hub for all the configuration of a given organization. And then we override or extend some of the settings that are unique to this particular repository. This then gets rolled out automatically anytime this file changes. Now there's a caveat to this approach that makes it not a silver bullet that it could be. If the upstream configuration changes, every dependent downstream repository configuration is not automatically updated. And that was a deliberate design choice from a security perspective. There's an open issue, they're tracking, there's a pull request that actually resolves that. If you wanted to self-host it, you could get that behavior today. The alternative is that you can do an empty commit on the settings file through programmatic means, and then it'll automatically trigger those hooks and roll out those changes as well. So that's how we're managing the settings of all the repositories. Now, there's one other thing I'd like to add here. A big reason that companies used to want to manage repository settings through Terraform is because managing branch protection rules is a real pain in the butt. But GitHub has fixed that through organizational rule sets. Now, if you're not using GitHub Enterprise, it's a little bit more limited. I think it's you can't manage it on private repos at the organizational level, but rule sets really solve a whole class of problems that you make it easy to solve branch protections at scale for your organization. So here's an example of how we've organized our branch protections, branch protection rules for Terraform modules for providers, something for at an app level. So we have Mergify installed. So a organizational wide repository rule set for how to manage Mergify configurations. So I think the combination of the repository settings app combined with repository rule sets, it's a perfect combination for managing configuration. Any questions on this? All right. And yeah, Michael, you were asking what browser am I using? Yeah, I was turned on to Arc a couple of months ago. Arc is the best browser I've ever used to date. It's really awesome because it lets you have this horizontal directory structure of all your bookmarks. It is very efficient about when things are new windows versus tabs. It lets you search all of your open bookmarks very easily and easily switch between your different profiles. Lots of other features as well. That's just the tip of the spear.
Yeah, the profiles are really powerful. If you have like five different Gmail accounts, you know, you're in consulting and you need to switch, it's really difficult to do that with Firefox, some plugins, but
well,
it's,
I mean,
Chrome, it's not as, this is the best of my experience.
I mean, Chrome has it as well. You always just click in the upper right corner. You can switch between the profiles. It just, I don't know, this small change of just having them down here just makes me use it all the time. So like when I go into a sale, so we're on the office hours profile right now, but if I'm going to go into a sales demo, I have my environment all set up here and every link that I'm going to need for a sales demo, I have right there. Or my personal email, or you know, my business profile as well here. So that's
the difference of Arc though in terms of the profiles is that you don't need to close it; it's all ready to go.
Yeah,
it's perfect for consulting. You just switch to the different tab for X client, and you have all the emails there. You don't have to close them. You switch back to the, are these called tabs? The things at the bottom. I guess they're tabs.
No, these are the. the profiles, or I think
It's
they
like
call them
a
spaces.
space.
Yeah, they call
Yeah.
them spaces. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, it's great. Who's it to?
And you can share a login session across spaces, which is really nice, I believe. So you can have one session and then use it in multiple spaces.
Is that a login session for Google, or is it, are you talking
Well,
about?
yeah, I guess you could say it. I guess you, I could be misstating things here, but it's more akin to like a shared cookie jar that can be used across spaces. So if you were logged into Google and that those cookies are in that cookie jar, you can use that cookie jar in another space, but with a different set of tabs and everything. So like when I click here, I can create a new space, but I can say which profile that I want to use. And that profile is, I guess that's what they've done. You know, there's another level of abstraction above profiles. So profiles are like your cookie jar. Also, a nice thing is that if you are using that this feature, you can share the folder with another member of your team. The only downside is they don't live update. I think it'd be really awesome from a team collaboration perspective, like a cloud posse that an engineer onboards and we can share a folder that's live updated with all the links that you need to get started. Unfortunately, it's a snapshot of that folder. Nonetheless, something useful. Cool. Any so I saw Rohan. Are you still here, or Rohit? No, different. Sorry, confused names there. Any other questions we can get answered today? Oh yeah, Elvis points out that it supports AI or ChatGPT built in. I found that functionality as implemented too annoying. I had to turn it off right away, or not right away. It took me 2 weeks to turn it off, but it was so annoying, I thought. But otherwise, what you can do is if you command F, if something is not found in the page, it defaults to ChatGPT, so you can interact intelligently with the page. I just found it, I just want to know if that string was in the page. I don't want to interact with ChatGPT every time I hit Command F. Let's see. We got another 10 minutes or so to answer questions. Anyone have questions?
Hi.
Hey there.
Yeah, thanks for the reply. Can you hear me okay? Just
Yeah,
making
I
sure.
hear you.
Thanks for the replies. Again, this is kind of my first. I mean, I've been using Kubernetes for a little bit, but in the past we just applied a lot of the manifest files with just kubectl or customize. So this is like my first foray into using Helm, except like
Oh.
some of the open source projects, they give you a prescribed way of deploying those
Yeah.
Helm charts, and it's another beast completely to build your own. For like a one pod, two jobs, and some things to happen in between, we ran like our team ran into a lot of weirdness with Helm and trying to accomplish this thing, and so right now we're just kind of leveraging a quick shell script to kind of do things like in piecemeal to accomplish this. But I have yet to read some of these things, but unfortunately in our circumstance we're trying to support a customer who's running Kubernetes on VMware, and from what we understood it's just like kind clusters behind the scenes with some opinionated controllers and things that are installed on top of it that the customer is running. And we don't even know how the customer is dealing with ingresses or how they authenticated to Vault from their Kubernetes clusters, because for all we know, they can be doing something completely outside of the prescribed way of doing things. And there, I know there isn't like a silver bullet solution to be able to deal with all sorts of things. So the short term, we're just using a script that kind of does things manually. Like we
Hold
have,
on. Let me just pause there. Sorry, Rohit. I realized that you're now the same person as Rohan in the Slack. So I was a little confused there.
Oh, I didn't even notice that. I think.
Yeah. Are you talking about the question that we had there in the office hours
Yeah.
chat? I
Thanks,
also
Bobby.
I saw you joined a little bit later. I want to make sure that I'm not misinterpreting. Did you hear our summary of the solution earlier in the office hours session?
No, I only got in like 5 minutes ago.
Oh, okay. About 20 minutes ago, we talked at
Okay.
length about this particular one. So I want to make sure we don't rehash a lot of
Sure.
the conversations there, but the TLDR, and it makes a lot more sense now that you added some of the context that you have experience with Kubernetes, but this is your first time really or foray into trying to do what you're doing right now. And some of the questions we had for you that were like, what assumptions can we make? And based on your answer there, it sounded like, that they're going to be on AWS. Is that a foregone conclusion? You're not going to distribute your software on other cloud platforms?
Not yet. This is our first customer, and we just wanted to get it working in their environment, take whatever feedback we can get to improve this for other ones. But effectively, the model is you bring your own cluster and infrastructure, right? And we deploy our product in your existing clusters.
To bring some old sage advice or experience, having done this before, when customers bring their own infrastructure or clusters, it's seldom what you have pictured it would be. How it's managed, how it's set up, what regions it's in, how many availability zones, what load balancer controller they're using, what level of AWS permission they have, do they have DNS names, and so forth. So some of the concerns we had that Yanni here brought up. So Yanni had some interesting insight because he worked at a CI/CD product or for a
Okay,
company that has,
Codefresh.
Codefresh. And they had some of these same problems. And you crawl, walk, run, and you start with something simple to just get it up. But it's to actually do it right is going to be hard and will have a lot of exceptions.
Trust me, that's kind of what we talked to our product owner about. Like the beginning of this project was, hey, you have to build everything and give the customer our code base, right? Like we deployed, we wrote a huge CDK project to deploy EKS and within a fully private or isolated network. And we had all of those things working out. And then the customer said, oh, wait, we can't actually use EKS. We have to use what we have. So we kind of scratched all of the infrastructure pieces and managing all the permissions and to just trying to, sensibly give them something that they can deploy. And since we were also depending on, the external Helm projects like AWS Load Balancer, Fluent Bit, Cert Manager, we thought it made sense to, hey, let's just put Helm around our project, add some dependencies to the other external Helm projects and get this done. But what we're quickly running into is Helm, has its own way of sorting through the different kinds of objects in Kubernetes and how it gets things installed. And you can use hooks to determine what goes first. But it's like we solve one problem with Helm and another one opens up,
Totally.
and like it, we just went back to the old tried and true, hey, let's just write a shell script that does all of this stuff. And we put the disclaimer for the customer that, hey, if something doesn't work outside of our recommendation or boundary, that's, we're here to help, but that's kind of on you. It didn't seem like a good response, right? I mean, no engineer wants to give that response to a customer, like, hey, you got have to figure that piece of it out. But
Well, and then, from the customer's point of view, what they have is totally conventional and by the book and just how you do it or whatever. It's their world. And then you're sitting at it from the other side, and it's totally different from the assumptions you had.
So how do you reconcile those sort of differences with customers, or like, maybe this is more of like a not a technical question, right? How do you get the customer to kind of meet you in the middle? I know there's going to be some customers who are just like, they could be fintech firms or some, industry with really, secure guardrails, and there's only so much we can do, but they really want to use our software. Like,
Well, so I just want to make sure you're familiar with a company that has solved this. It's not cheap, but I mean, what you're bringing up is what they identify.